Hi everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering, the geek show's dedicated books and arts and cultural anarchy podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today are Graham.
Hello.
And Andrew.
I stopped watching House on Haunt... No, wait, Haunting a Hill. The spooky Hill House TV show on the Netflix. You all better be grateful for this.
See, I got really confused with that title, and I kept calling it The House on Harry Hill. The Haunting of Harry Hill.
That's excellent. I would get a Netflix account to watch that.
It conjures up some bizarre images of him being attacked by that giant collar he wears.
I mean, Harry Hill having a little house on his head that's full of ghosts. What would be just a Harry Hill sketch?
Yes, it would. Yes. So how are you guys today?
I'm okay, yes. It's quite strange because it's Sunday evening, which is not when we normally record, but, you know, it's fine. I don't fear all change, just most of it.
It could be worse. We could be recording outside in this weather.
That's very true, yes. It's horrible weather.
It is. I thought that, but then didn't say it with my mouth words. I'm quite ill, by the way.
Are you?
I've got the old flu.
Oh.
It's the old flu, specifically the old flu, not the new flu.
Yeah, we don't like that fancy new flu around here. That's one of the changes that I don't like, the new flu.
Oh, there's loads of them. There's loads of these newfangled flus. There's the swine flu, there's the chicken flu, there's the bird flu, there's
the
man flu.
They should absolutely go back to the original recipe. It's like they've learned nothing from what Coca-Cola did in the 80s.
It literally is like the many flavours of Coca-Cola now, isn't it?
Yes.
See, the bit I hate is how my flu keeps interrupting me, asking to update.
Yeah. Hang on, you got like a hallucination of a paperclip next to you.
Oh dear. Should we start off with some news that is almost as scientific as our dissection of the flu virus?
Yes.
Because I've found a bit of theatre news, a review from The Guardian, of a stage show by Isabella Rossellini, the legendary star of Blue Velvet and many other films.
Yeah.
But who cares about those other ones?
It's the legendary star of Blue Velvet and other films that I haven't watched because David Lynch didn't direct them. But yes, she is currently in, let me see where she is at the moment. She is currently in Belfast.
Sorry, the way you said it, it just made it sound like you've got a tracker on her somewhere.
According to Google Earth, she is currently in Belfast doing a one-woman show called Link Link, except it's not strictly a one-woman show. She's doing it with, and this might be my favourite name we've ever had on this show, Shoyla B-Man.
What?
What?
Shoyla B-Man.
Is that what Shia Booth or Shia Beef is calling himself these days?
Has B-Man had to team up with her because they keep going for leading roles, but they're always shot down? So, I'm sorry, you're not a lead, you're just a B-Man.
I am starting to feel that Marvel are scraping the bottom of the barrel for superheroes when they have to produce a B-Man movie.
I've got to ask, how are you spelling B-Man?
Oh, exactly like you think I am.
B-E-E-M-A-N or B-M-A-N?
Yeah, the latter, that would be a surname. No, it's B-E-E-M-A-N. And, guys, he performs in a beekeeper's headdress.
Wait, so it's not just a name then? He has gone in for the whole B-Man theme.
It's not just a name, it's a whole lifestyle. You can't just call yourself the B-Man, you have to be the B-Man.
See, I would have gone the whole hog and just said, nope, I'm going to wear all this and I'm going to be the anti-Candy Man.
The review is quite negative, but I've got to say the description of this makes it sound like the best thing ever, as well as the fact that it contains a photo of a very happy-looking Rossellini wearing novelty gorilla costume arms. But
I'm sold already.
I know, right?
I'm sold already.
God, I know. In stark contrast to a lot of the stories you have, sometimes the art world is great, isn't it?
Yeah. Isabella Rossellini with novelty gorilla arms. Just...
teaming up with her sidekick, the beekeeper.
No, the bee man. The bee man.
Wait, do we actually get to see inside his bee suit?
I mean, I don't think it's that kind of show.
But I just mean, so there's no way of confirming that he is not, in fact, just an entire colony of bees.
According to Guardian theatre critic Arifa Akbar, much of the performance veers into surreal whimsy. I mean, you don't say. Rossellini is dressed as a stylish court jester as she enters the stage, after shrieking and hiding behind the curtain, accompanied by a soundtrack of clucking hens. The show comprises stories told by Rossellini in a hodgepodge of forms, including films, skits, and the odd circus trick by her pet dog, Pan, who trots onto the stage, sometimes dressed as a chicken, sheep, or lion.
I mean, that's... I assume they mean it's a bunch of different costumes. But I really hope it's just one costume. Is that a chicken? Or a sheep?
See,
no, lion. It's a lion, maybe.
Either that or the dog is wearing one costume but projecting so powerfully that everyone's just imagining. I mean, that dog has stage presence then, doesn't it?
Yes. But this is derived from... She's been passionate about animals for quite a long time. She made a series of short films for, I think, the Sundance Channel called Green Porno, where she described the different mating habits of different kind of animals with the help of a lot of homemade animal costumes and enormous novelty prop penises.
I mean, there's nothing about that that doesn't sound incredible.
It's like, sometimes when an actor's career sort of loses a bit of its heat, they just start making bad B-movies, no pun intended, obviously, or they go on to TV, or they just do something else that's quite boring.
Or get cast in lots and lots of action movies, Liam Neeson.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. I don't think anyone's come up with something as joyful to do with, like, your late career as Isabella Rossellini has.
Yeah.
Do you know,
as much as I would love to see Isabella Rossellini on the next series of Celebs Go Dating, I think this is probably better.
See, I'm looking at this as kind of, you know, when grandmas go and get a purple rinse and decide to just throw all cares to the wind and just say whatever the hell they want.
this is very like, much like yeah, that, it, yeah.
It's like the art world's version of that, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it really is.
Although, to be honest, I'm a bit disappointed.
Hmm?
But mainly that just so much of the focus is on Rossellini and her kind of failing career. Because apparently, Shirley Beeman does a really great performance. I've heard a lot of buzz about it.
See, you know when you said maybe it's just a colony of bees in a beekeeper suit?
Yes.
Which, oh, fun fact for Graham. That's an actual Marvel character.
Excellent.
Yeah. My immediate reaction to that was, I hope in the review it says, you know, that Shola Beeman's performance was quite mumbled, because then you could have mumblebees.
Oh, I'm missing Doctor Who for this rubbish.
Oh.
But that's great. I love Isabella Rossellini, and I would pay any amount of money to watch her dog do tricks while she just had a bit of a goof around with the bee man.
Maybe that's one of her movies.
It could be. It does sound like Guy Maddin probably directed that at some point.
Yep.
It also does sound like a sick rap duo.
Yes.
Dog trick and the bee man.
There's the episode title.
I think that item has given us more episode titles than, like, most shows we've done put together.
Yeah, from now on, the show titles aren't actually going to have any relevance to that show. It's just all going to be stuff from this one.
Yeah,
it's all going to be references to Isabella Mussolini's dog.
Yeah.
Someone else who has had a good week. I assume Isabella Mussolini's had a good week. I know I would have if I was doing that.
I don't think she actually cares about what the reviewers said.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if you're putting a performance on like that, then you no longer care what anyone thinks. The world is your mollusk, because I got told off for saying the world is your oyster. I literally got told off. Seriously, I got told off because I was was it obfuscating or something like that? They used some complicated word. The rest of the mollusk community.
Were you not being inclusive enough towards mussels?
I was really kind of shocked that I got told off for saying the world is your oyster because, you know, mussels and barnacles and things like that, they're all mollusks, so, you know, they should be included as well.
Were you on the BBC? Did you have to say that other bivalves are available?
No, I wasn't. Unfortunately, I was in Stockton.
Yes, that's about as far from being on the BBC as you possibly can.
Yes. See, I always thought only bizarre things like that happened in South Bank.
someone else who's had a good week this week in the world of arts and literature is Anna Burns, who has just become, I believe, the first Northern Irish winner of the Man Booker Prize.
Hooray.
Hey, good for her.
Number one for being Northern Irish and number two for being a woman.
Yes. It's going very well for her. And more importantly, because let's face it, money makes the world go round, the book is selling staggeringly well, despite a lot of people responding to the news of her novel Milkman winning by saying it's very difficult and we're not sure how well that's going to perform commercially.
And the book is difficult.
Apparently.
Isn't that kind of the point?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Did it just mean it's got lots of those big words in?
I don't know. Kwame Anthony Appiah, the chair of the judging panel, said, described it as challenging, but, and I quote, in the way that a walk up Snowdon is challenging, it is definitely worth it because the view is terrific when you get to the top. Because of the flow of the language and the fact that some of the language is unfamiliar, it is not a light read, but I think it's going to last.
Please, sir, I have a question.
Oh, yes.
He said it was like a walk up Snowdon. Have you ever walked up Snowdon?
I can't say I have.
I tried, I failed, and all I can say is reading a book is nothing like walking up Snowdon.
Yeah, that's true. I imagine many of the judging panel of the Man Booker Prize have not walked up Snowdon.
We are going to have to take a short break while I explain what a metaphor is.
It's bizarre to me that they would call a book challenging when that's the whole point of a book.
Yeah, you say that, but I think there's plenty of unchallenging books around.
Yeah, but if you're finding them unchallenging, it means that you need to increase the difficulty level.
Oh, completely, yes, yeah. So, yeah, no, I completely agree with you. There's lots of remarkable statistics in here about how well Milkman is selling after the prize win. It has gone up 1,200% week on week. There are currently 180,000 copies in print, which is after her publisher's Faber were forced to print 120,000 more to meet increased demand. It is ninth place in the bookseller's top 50, ahead of new titles by Ian Rankin and Joanna Trollope. It's pretty good, but there is a bit of a catch.
Oh?
She now has to do a bit of paperwork, because, you see, Anna Burns was so off the radar before she wrote Milkman that she was actually claiming Job Seeker's allowance.
Wow.
She now has 30 days to let the DWP know that she has had a minor change in her circumstances.
I'd love to see them do the usual bureaucratic. So, do you have any evidence of this change?
Yes! Look, Ms. Burns, this being a best-selling author's thing is all well and good, but have you been actively looking for work in the past 30 days?
Oh, that's just beautiful.
It really is.
And I'll be honest...
I'm not sure it was a joke.
See, I'll be honest, when you said milkman and the fact that she's Northern Irish, you know, my brain immediately went Father Ted to that episode where Father Dougal takes over the milk round.
It's the gritty origin story of Pat Mustard. Oh my God, the novel is actually described as a story of sexual intimidation during the Troubles. I can totally see Pat Mustard doing that.
That was his entire deal.
Yes! We've destroyed this book now.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean it.
But that would be quite a feeling, wouldn't it, to go in and when, as Andrew says, asked for any change of circumstances, just slam the Booker Trophy down on their desk.
Yes.
I mean, I don't think she'll have that much trouble getting it acknowledged because it will mean her signing off benefits. If it was for her signing on benefits, yeah, expect that one to go through sometime around September.
Oh, yeah, but given the bureaucracy now, they'll try and say that even though she's won the prize, technically, she'd won the prize when she wrote the book, and that means that, you know, they basically have to reclaim this amount of money off her.
Yes. That's almost certainly going to happen, isn't it?
Yeah. Bureaucracy is just the devil, isn't it?
Yep.
It's such a shame that only sort of one person, you know, ever wins these prizes, of course. Can't there be a system of more universal credit?
Oh, God.
Oh. Boo, Graham. Boo.
That was even worse than my one about mumblebees.
Now, normally around this time, in fact, normally earlier than this time, we have a bit of Trump book news, don't we?
Yeah.
Oh, no. I thought there was an ill wind.
Okay, see, that's a good one.
Yes. It took me a second, but it is good. Well, it must have been a quiet week, or maybe not enough senior members of the White House have been sacked in to write a new book, because there isn't a new book around Trump that everyone's talking about. What there is a very, very old book.
Is it The Art of the Deal?
It's not The Art of the Deal, although the ongoing saga of his ghostwriter Tony Schwartz looking at what he has created, like Frankenstein beholding his monster, is very amusing.
Please say it's that book that Trump reckons he wrote about the... What was it about, Andrew? The one that was set in Trump Tower and it was...
The dirty porn book.
Yes.
No, I assume this is a story about someone unearthing some kind of ancient Babylonian scroll with a depiction of Nurgle, god of plague. And he's going, wait a second.
Sorry, Nurgle's such a good name. I'm just tickled by the name Nurgle, god of plague.
It is the weeniest of all the god names.
It is.
Is that actually a researched thing? Is there really a Nurgle?
Oh yeah, Nurgle is like a real god. I think he's like the god of pestilence in Babylonian folklore. These are factually accurate jokes I make, Graham.
Is he called that because everyone was so busy dying that they couldn't think up a better name?
Oh, maybe that's the sound they made as they were dying, Nurgle.
Maybe. Yes.
I'm sorry. That was a dark joke. I'm sorry.
It's about to get darker because we're talking about Brett Kavanaugh.
Oh, no.
God.
Yes. During the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, a book was raised by Democratic Senator Pat Leahy. Democratic Senator Pat Leahy, you will know, incidentally, on this side of the pond from his frequent cameos in Batman movies. He's a huge Batman fan. the guy who Heath Ledger's Joker threatens with a knife and says, "You remind me of my father," Pat Leahy.
Wait, for real?
Serious, yeah.
Huh.
But yes, his current crusade is not to help Batman clean up Gotham. He's done sterling work on that in the past. It's to get to the bottom of the allegations surrounding Brett Kavanaugh's university days. And
I can get to the bottom of the allegations.
Mm-hmm.
It's that he definitely did it, and America's terrible and horrible, and the system is broken.
Jobs are good, and guys, anyone got any further? No? Is it closed? Yeah, I think that's fair.
I've got nothing to add.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm tiptoeing through this because, of course, as the show's host, I might be held legally responsible for, for any legal consequences. But anyway, the alcoholic gang rapist was asked about a book by Mark Gavro Judge, an American conservative journalist, called Wasted, Tales of a Gen X Drunk, which sold very badly at the time. And was reviewed in rapturous terms, including the Times Book Review, where Michael Newman said, "In the end, Wasted does stand as a cautionary tale, not necessarily for alcoholics, but for anyone who wants to write about alcoholism."
So not a fan, then?
Not a fan. The book is now out of print, the rights have reverted to the author, but a lot of people are willing to pony up very large sums of money to get hold of one of the few still existing copies, because Mark Gavro Judge went to university with Brett Kavanaugh.
Ooh.
He was in his social circle. They were drinking buddies. And Wasted contains a character called, and I swear to God, this is the impenetrable pseudonym Gavro Judge came up with for his old friend, Bart O'Kavanaugh.
I'm sorry, that's like Bruce Wayne deciding that he wasn't going to call himself Batman, he was going to call himself Bruce Man.
Yes! Bruce McWayne Ridge.
Oh, Batwayne.
Wait a minute. What if Bart O'Kavanaugh is really Brett Kavanaugh?
Dun dun dun!
The very strange things about the Trump administration is that I'm a keen reader of the American journalist Roy Adrosal, who's a very funny left-wing writer from America, and he has a particular talent for isolating the most ridiculous no-hopers in American conservative media. And now, obviously, they're all in senior positions of government power. But I wasn't expecting Mark Gavro Judge to be like the centre of a Trump administration scandal, because Adrosal has been writing about Gavro Judge for ages. And when this story came up, I did a search for Mark Gavro Judge on Adrosal's website, and I have two excerpts of his writing that I think show the man at his best. "Can the Hollywood reboot of the Fantastic Four, now in the works, succeed where the original movies failed? It all depends on whether producer Matthew Vaughn and director Josh Trank have the guts to do one thing, to make the Fantastic Four about the family versus communism."
What?
Apparently someone has an idea on how to make an even worse Fantastic Four movie than the one they made.
I mean, that's someone who has read the first issue of Fantastic Four. Where Reed Richards says, "We've got to launch this rocket to beat the Reds." And thought, yes, that is what this film needs to be.
Also, I cannot imagine any of the subsequent comics would be about anything other than that. I assume Fantastic Four, as you noted earlier, Mark, I'm not a superhero guy, but I assume it's just about rocket building.
Well,
yep, that's it. You've hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, I mean,
But no, also I want to point out that literally every single comic book from the 1960s is about communism.
Yeah. And shouldn't we also point out that after they had got hit by cosmic rays and the original version of the Fantastic Four anyway, the whole idea of communism was the last thing on their minds as they went on to discover other dimensions, micro-universes, various things like that.
A secret Hitler.
Yes.
In other words, they sold out, is what you're saying, right? It could have been a good comic about building a rocket to trigger the Reds. And they went and discovered other dimensions and superpowers and stretchy arms and things. No kid's going to want to read that.
Yeah, but see, they had to, Graham. Because the thing about old comics is they were never at any point political.
This is true.
Yes, they were. Comics get you thundering arseholes.
I think before we go on to a book review, an actual book review, I'm afraid we're going to have another sample of Mark Gavreau Judge's writing.
Okay.
And this one, this is when you know that a Republican blogger is going to pull out something really great. This one's about Lena Dunham.
Oh, dear.
Girls creator Lena Dunham is very talented, and she's only 26. But it has to be said, like so many liberal Hollywood and New York artists, she has a powerful streak of cowardice. The girls in Girls are frustrated because the guys they date are either passive, psychotic, pretentious, degrading, or plain old losers. But what if Dunham had written in a male character who is strong, caring, attractive, highly intelligent, sexually unambiguous, great in bed, and a conservative? How about this? A handsome grad student from Fordham who is Catholic, articulate, a college football star, compassionate, manly, and can debate any liberal to a standstill. Maybe his flaw is that he drinks too much, or that he once bullied a gay kid.
Can I just point out, that guy is probably highly racist.
Can I just point out that man's name is probably Bart O'Kavanagh?
Oh, Batwayne.
I was going to make a joke like that, but I couldn't get past or bullied a gay kid. Yeah.
What I want to know is, how the hell has he written 5 books?
I mean, quite easily, apparently. He just smashes his face into the keyboard.
I found the titles for his books. Do you want to know what they are?
Desperately.
His first one was, in 97, Wasted, Tales of a Gen X Drunk.
Mm-hmm.
In 2000, If It Ain't Got That Swing, The Rebirth of Grown-Up Culture. In the year 2000...
Yeah, I that works, didn't it? With what was the big things in 2000? Limp Bizkit and the Charlie's Angels reboot.
Oh, also celebrating the fact that we made it into the new millennium without all the computers failing.
That's that.
You know, in 2003, you know, he's quite prolific. 6 years, 3 books. Damn Senators, My Grandfather and the Story of Washington's Only World Series Championship.
That just sounds so dull.
Yeah. In 2000,
I think a little something died when I heard that title.
Yeah. In 2005, God and Man at Georgetown Prep, How I Became a Catholic Despite 20 Years of Catholic Schooling.
And despite all the other stuff I did at university.
Yes. I think you became a Catholic despite the 20 years of Catholic schooling because of all the things that you did, and you were feeling a little bit guilty about them, and so you wanted absolving. In the way that all good Catholics do.
He should just have the courage to call it, I've had my fun, now no one else is allowed to have theirs.
Yeah. And then he had a 5-year gap until 2010, when he was no longer called Mark Gavreau Judge.
Oh.
I keep wanting to say Guava, Mark Guava Judge. he just called himself Mark Judge after that. And his book in 2010 was A Tremor of Bliss, Sex, Catholicism, and Rock and Roll.
Oh.
All those Christian rock groups, now we know what they get up to.
That is... I don't think I could imagine anything more, like, sad middle-aged man attempting to be cool.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
It's like a thousand leather jackets cried out in agony in sudden silence.
Oh, that did indeed give me a tremor of bliss.
It's just so bad, isn't it?
Yes. I know we said we'd do a book review next, but that feels like a good segue to talking about odd titles in general.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, yeah, let's go for it.
It's Diagram Prize time.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, Diagram Prize, the annual award dedicated to finding the most bizarre book titles, previous winners, including How to Avoid Huge Ships, Greek Rural Postman and Their Cancellation Numbers.
Which is one of my personal favourites.
And Too Naked for the Nazis.
Which we got told off about by the author.
Sounds great. I'll say that. I read up about that book afterwards. It sounds really good.
Yeah, I mean, we made a comment and we comment about it and what we thought the book was about, you know, just based on the title, and we got told off by the author.
We should maybe research some of the things we talk about.
Well, I mean,
it's too late for that now.
I know one of the winners of the Diagram Prize was The Big Book of Lesbian Horse Stories, which...
I think we're back to Father Ted again, aren't we?
It is a very Father Ted title.
Yes, the Diagram, I hate to say this because I think we've just won our Comicsgate readers back. I think their Mayfly minds have just forgotten Andrew insulting them. But it's gone political, guys.
Oh?
They've opened it up to European titles.
It's inclusivity gone mad is what it is.
Oh, please say there's a list. Please say there's a list.
There sure is. Managing editor and judge Tom Tivnan has said that the one of the front runners was written in German. It's called The Joy of Water Boiling.
Oh, that's... You know, a lot of the time I hate to play into cultural stereotypes, but... Oh, it's so German.
It's so good as well.
It is, in fact, a guide on how to cook with kettles. Yeah.
Step one, you turn the kettle on. Step two, wait for it to boil.
They're so efficient. Yes, other titles include... Ho Chi Angel Owls, Queer Studies Text. Are gay men more accurate in detecting deceits?
What?
Yeah.
Deceits as in lies?
I assume so.
Okay. Okay.
This season on Queer Eye. That's for Link Inspector. Solve a 20-year-old murder case.
Oh, God, can you imagine? It would be Queer Eye crossed with Lie to Me, wouldn't it?
It would be like the Making a Murderer of camp reality TV. Why were they not at the Kavanaugh hearing?
Oh, God, yeah.
Others include Call of Nature, The Secret Life of Dung.
Oh, God, please. I'm just remembering the big book of poo.
Yes, this is mentioned. There are previous scatological winners, including How to Poo on a Date and Cooking with Poo.
We have actually covered How to Poo on a Date, thanks to Andy, back when we were still on community radio.
Oh, right. Yeah.
We did actually do How to Poo on a Date.
There is a Methodist minister called David Musket has written a book called Jesus on Gardening.
Finally, the lost gospel.
Yeah, a couple more. There's one here which I think should be disqualified on account of the fact that it's funnier when you know what it's about. which is Cornelia Klarholz and Andrea Schatzinger and their book Equine Dry Needling.
What?
I mean, on its own, it's just perplexing, but then you hear it's a guide to acupuncture for horses.
I mean, I was expecting this to be some kind of obscure horse rearing thing, but
I was expecting it to be like a cross stitch guide, but do horses even have complex enough brains for the placebo effect to...
See, the thing is, I know a good bit about acupuncture in Chinese medicine and how it's associated with spirituality and the I Ching and various things like that. I know how it's all supposed to fit together. And horses don't fit there anywhere.
Yeah, how many horses do you know that could understand that? Even lesbian horses, who are often more sensitive and literary and have books written for them.
Yes.
Understand that.
Are we sure this isn't actually a Findus cookbook for all games?
Oh.
The final book, which the judges have made a magnificently snarky comment about, is by the entrepreneur Paul Oberschneider. Oberschneider!
Oberschneider!
which is called Why Sell Tacos in Africa?
That is a good question.
Now, part of the reason why they've chosen this, they admit, is because they were incredibly irked by the back cover, which says that the book will show there are, and I quote, no magic beans for success, to which the judges have added, beans are in tacos.
Oh, I've just seen my... I remember my favourite book title from the Diagram Prize.
Yeah.
I've just seen it. Managing a Dental Practice, the Genghis Khan Way.
Yes, it wouldn't go to Genghis Khan's relaxing dentistry.
A large man covered in furry armour on a little horse.
Played by John Wayne.
Oh, yeah, saying, open wide.
At which point a horde of tiny people rush into your mouth and tear out all your teeth.
Yes. Oh, I love the Diagram Prize.
It's so great.
I reckon. I have to say, my money is on the joy of waterballing. Not waterballing.
I must say, the joy, I read it as the joy of waterboarding, which made me wonder if Gina Haspel was among the judges this year.
I've got to say, that one, or are gay men more accurate in detecting deceits? Because I think Call of Nature is too easy.
Yes, yeah.
Yes, I think that one's just, it's funny because it's got poo in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I felt like that about some of the last ones. I think you've got to kind of, you've got to draw the line somewhere.
Oh, God, I've just realised.
I mean, I, for one, am backing Sassy Gay Detective Squad.
Yeah, Sassy Gage. Oh, that would be an amazing name for that book, wouldn't it?
Yes.
I've just realised, you know, the equine dry needling.
Yeah.
For some reason, my brain took a sharp left turn. And, you know, needling can also be, you know, just poking somebody repeatedly, you know, with comments.
Yeah, just annoying them. Or, yeah.
My brain went down the route of having Andrew standing next to a horse, just dryly making sarcastic comments about it.
Oh, man. I think we could definitely win the Diagram Prize with how to annoy a horse.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Let's have a book review. Let's get things back onto Terra Firma.
Yes. Terra Firma. In this case, quite literally terror. It's not a scary book in the normal sense. It's a scary book because of how close to reality it could be. This is Halcyon by Ryo Yuas. And Paul Tremblay said, it's a tornado of a novel. Sarah Pimbra says, Yuas is a kunz or king for a new generation. It starts off very, very straightforward. It's about a young girl called Edith, who's 10 years old, and her sister Shirley. And they live with their mum and dad, Martin and Laura.
Yeah.
And Edith wakes up screaming one evening. and she's basically drawing on the walls, and she's drawing some random some words, and she's scared of what her supposed night terror is, and she basically reaches out to her sister for comfort, for security. Her sister Shirley, who's older than her by 5 years, her sister is now a teenager. She wants to basically live her own life, and she doesn't want to carry Edith's burdens anymore. So Edith is trying to deal with this herself, but it's just too much. The night terror is just too much, and she's screaming. And next thing you know, Shirley has a fit, and her parents see her having a fit, and they're scared of what's going on. She's typing weird stuff on her phone, and she says Edith's screaming, and so her dad runs upstairs and finds Edith basically screaming, and she's been drawing all over the walls. And her mom and dad are thinking, well, we don't know what's going on. But it turns out they do know what's going on. They're just in denial, because Edith has psychic abilities that are extremely powerful. And she's had a premonition of a terrorist attack. And the problem is, the terrorist attack goes through, and it's all linked together. Everything that happens from then on is linked together. This is one of the things that I like about Ryo Yours. This is the first book I've read of his, but I really like him as an author. He's basically got two main plot threads here. The first one is set on the island of Halcyon, and it's about this organization who are looking for a way to get to Glam Moon. So it sounds like a cult, and effectively it is a cult, and Mother Moon is basically the leader of the cult. But they seem to be harmless on the surface. The other aspect of it is about Martin Lovegrove and his family, and how Edith's abilities affect them. And the two eventually do clash. It starts off as a real slow burn and builds up and builds up. Things keep happening that Edith can see, but she doesn't know how to cope with them. And the one person who kind of shines a light on the on their life in the early part of this novel is a psychic who they discover. Now, this is one of the things I love about this, because it's very true to how America is now, right?
Yeah.
With the whole aspect of the gun culture, with aspects of people trying to make a quick buck off, out of someone else's misery, Laura and Martin call in supposed experts to try and help their daughter. And the experts set up a camera and everything like that, but then quickly turn around and say, well, you know, we've got this idea for a TV series. We can film your daughter having these premonitions, and we can fight the premonitions, yada, yada, yada. We can make millions.
Yeah.
Because these people aren't experts. They're not. They're just faking it in an effort to make money off their daughter's misery. To which Martin says, take your stuff, get out of my house before I shove it up your ass and choke you to death on it. Words to that effect, which any parent would do. But what I love about this in particular is Ryo's take on this whole idea of psychic abilities.
Mm.
The person who eventually comes to the rescue and helps Edith, the youngest daughter, try and protect herself from her abilities, effectively, she explains to Edith what her abilities actually are, because she has similar abilities, but she's much older and she's an old woman now. Who's basically they treat like an aunt who they love having over and staying to visit them. But the way they call it is, after they've exhausted all of the possibilities, they've got this photo of this woman called Carm Dumas, and they put the photo on the table, and they basically, Laura and Martin, the parents, while the kids are asleep, just start saying Carm Dumas repeatedly, and then they kind of wake up from what looks to be a trance, say, oh, it's only about 10 minutes, nope, try 3 hours. That they've been chanting Carm Dumas, which at some point turned into Come to Us.
Right.
And so Carm Dumas does go to them, because nobody knows where she is. People reach out to her, not the other way around, which is one of the aspects I love. And Carm Dumas is very, very powerful in this book, a very powerful psychic, but she's found ways to protect herself. And they throw in a little bit of kind of wormhole theory and stuff like that. The way she's done it is by creating what's effectively her own little world.
Yeah.
Her own little piece of reality that she can access, and that's where she sends her mind to protect it when the world gets too much, when the real world gets too much. And she says, these aren't gifts, these abilities, they're not gifts. They're more like a condition. And the way they liken it is to, say, schizophrenia or something like that, where these people need help. And she says, look, if psychics truly had control over these abilities, they'd be in Vegas running the tables. They wouldn't be hiding in a closet wanting to kill themselves.
Hmm.
And I love the take on it, that it's a condition rather than natural gift. And it's something that they struggle with rather than wallowing in. But anyway, leaving that to one side, the book is really, really well written. As I said, it is a slow burn, but it keeps you hooked from the very first pages. You want to know more about Martin Lovegrove and Laura and the kids. And there is a tragedy within the family. It actually says on the back, you kind of guess what it is straight away.
Mm.
The reason why Martin eventually takes his family to Halcyon in the first place. You guess what it is. But what I love about the way this is written is that it doesn't start off with that. It starts off with the family unit as a whole. Right? Mm. It doesn't start off with a fractured family unit or anything like that. It starts off with the family unit as a whole. It's just Edith's night terrors. The one blip on an otherwise idyllic lifestyle. Halcyon days, effectively.
Yeah.
I get it.
Whereas the island of Halcyon is supposed to be the place where they can retreat from the world and protect themselves for a while until they're ready to go out into the world again. And so that's the great thing, because when the tragedy eventually strikes, you feel it more because you've got to know the character up to that point.
Yeah.
Well, to know the characters up to that point, and you associate yourself more with the rest of the cast's thoughts and feelings. There's a realism to how they behave and how they act, which I really like seeing. I mean, it does involve terrorism, it does involve cults, it does involve brainwashing, it does involve psychic powers and various things like that. But it's the plausibility that makes it all the more terrifying. It's less of the kind of traditional horror of vampires, monsters, zombies, whatever you want to call them, and more the, you know, this could happen because it already has happened.
Yeah.
These things could happen. I mean, you remember the Branch Davidians? There was that crazy guy with the sarin gas in Japan.
Yeah.
Charles Manson.
Yeah.
So these kind of cults, these kind of death cults, effectively, do exist.
Hmm.
And I really like this book. I'm going to pick up some of Ryo Yua's other books, because he's written a few, but this is the first one I've read. I am a fan, though.
Yeah.
I'm definitely a fan.
I can see from what you've described why Paul Tremblay likes it, because I think a lot of the things that you noted as positives, the plausibility, the psychological detail, the focus on a loving family unit as part of a horror story, are also things I enjoyed in The Cabin at the End of the World.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't, in The Cabin at the End of the World, it's similar in a lot of ways, but it's also very, very different, because there are quite a few characters in Halcyon. There are a lot more characters in Halcyon, I think, than are in Cabin at the End of the World. And so you have to find that balance between the characters. You have to kind of justify their actions. Why are they doing the things that they're doing? I mean, the revelations about Mother Moon towards the end of the book are just, they're amazing. But they also make you empathize or sympathize with the character more, but also hate her more as well.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a weird thing to feel when you're reading a book, that you can sympathize with the character, but you hate the character even more.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah. It can explain, but without excusing.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about this book is that it shows you a lot without telling you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Halcyon, I highly recommend.
That does sound really good. Yeah, I'd quite like to read that myself.
I shall bring it to the next meeting.
Don't bring it to the next meeting, because I'll be in Cambridge, but the meeting after that, golden.
I mean, you can still bring it to the next meeting, just, like, you know, hold it close to you. Keep it as a comfort.
Minimalist cushion.
Yes. It's a cracking book, I've got to say. It's kind of rekindled my faith in modern authors to a degree. I didn't need a rekindling that much. It's just I've read a lot of books that are, especially in this year of 2018, I've read a lot of books that effectively could be written by authors from 10, 15, 20 years ago, and they're very, very derivative stories.
I know what you mean, yeah.
But this one I like because it's very modern. It's got a very modern feel to it, and it's got that plausibility to it, but it's purely set in the here and now, in the present, with the world as it is now.
Yeah. And I think that's really powerful when you see it in the context of a genre story, and you can map it onto the world you see outside and think, that's how this current world in this current setup would react to this idea.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So, yeah, I think that's us, isn't it?
I think that, yeah, that's everything covered. I mean, we've talked about everything. We've talked about Booker Prize winners going off the dole. We've talked about Bartle Kavanagh, and we've had a book review. That's everything.
Yep, I concur.
Awesome. So, yeah, if you want to catch up with any of our other shows, you'll find them all on our website, along with everything else that we do. And that's thegeekshow.co.uk. You also find our shop and our Patreons if you want to show your support. You can do so by clicking on those links. We'll see you in a fortnight. Until then, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And we've done the thing.
We always do the thing.
Yeah, for me, we should just work out an order for this.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Alphabetical. The alphabet's good, isn't it? I think that stuff's lasted.
I don't trust it.
It's stood the test of time. You're scared of tradition, Andrew. Is that your thing?
That is my thing, because I've been Andrew. Boom, snuck in with it.
And I've been Graham the Change Fearer.
And we'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.